Section 4 of Oscar Wilde Twice Defended by Robert Harborough Sherard. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. An interview with Mr. George Bernard Shaw. In the summer of this year, 1932, Mr. Robert Sherard wrote to me about my study of Frank Harris, which had appeared in the spring. In the course of this study, I had shown again and again, while analysing Harris's autobiography, that he was completely unable to discriminate between what had happened and what he preferred to think had happened, whether in his own life or in the lives of others. By the time I reached Harris's biography of Wilde, charity or exhaustion had weakened my detective zeal, and, while taking the same general view of Harris's attitude to Wilde as Mr. Sherard takes in the following pages, I accepted as true the legend of the yacht at Erith, and two or three other important episodes of the book. Mr. Sherard, in his letter, put me right on these points, and after some further correspondence, sent me his destructive and absolutely convincing analysis of Harris's Wilde. I wrote to Mr. Sherard, who was in Corsica, saying that Mr. Shaw ought to see this analysis, which would convince him of his mistake in endorsing Harris's Wilde as the book by which Wilde must stand or fall. Mr. Sherard consented to my approaching Bernard Shaw on the matter. I therefore wrote to Mr. Shaw, giving the most important points in Mr. Sherard's indictment of Harris. Mr. Shaw replied that no doubt the famous lugger, the yacht at Erith, existed only in Frank's imagination, but that he was certain it would have materialised had Oscar consented. He went on to say, in defence of Harris's pictures of Wilde's unrestrained debauchery in his last years, that it was clearly not plain living and high thinking which prevented Wilde writing in Paris, and he ended by suggesting that to convict Harris of 100 lies would not discredit his powers of portraiture, though it might rake up all the mud into which Oscar finally sank, and once more obscure and befoul his very considerable literary achievements, and the momentary nobilities of which he was capable. "My verdict on Frank's memoir," he wrote, "stands until I read a better one." A postcard accompanied this letter. Mr. Shaw suggested on it that I should persuade Sherard to let poor Oscar alone, and not take up his vaguely remembered disgraces for the sake of throwing another handful of soot at Harris, which wouldn't whitewash Oscar. The postcard concluded with an invitation to come and talk the matter over. On the Sunday before I called on Mr. Shaw, London was placarded with "Oscar Wilde's Arrest," for the serialisation of Edward Marjoribanks's Life of Lord Carson in the Sunday Express had just reached that important moment in Lord Carson's career. When Mr. Shaw opened our talk by expressing his regret that Wilde's follies could not be left in the oblivion which was fast covering them, I asked him what he thought of the placards announcing Oscar Wilde's arrest, which were on view throughout London on the previous Sunday. Mr. Shaw, who had spent the weekend in the country, was taken aback. I pressed the point as far as I could. It was indeed more than a point, it was a complete and unassailable argument for saving Wilde from liars and sensation-mongers. But in the verbal prize ring, the effect of a knockdown blow is entirely neutralised if its recipient chooses to overlook the fact that it has been delivered. "You know," said Mr. Shaw, "Harris's Wilde is far more interesting than the real Wilde." "But, Mr. Shaw, the point isn't whether Harris's Wilde is more interesting than Wilde was. The point is whether his biography deserves to be endorsed by you as the authoritative life by which Wilde must stand or fall. You call Wilde, on the strength of Harris's picture of his last days, an unproductive drunkard and swindler. If you would look through Sherard's manuscript, I am sure you would not send down this phrase uncorrected to posterity. I then gave in outline the evidence which Mr. Sherard had collected from Wilde's landlord and from Monsieur Chiappe, prefect of the Paris police, evidence which conclusively showed that Harris's picture was a malicious slander. Mr. Shaw looked thoughtful over Monsieur Chiappe. I felt that I was getting him into a corner, but a moment later he was back in the middle of the ring, listening with courteous attention to my attack on the disgusting and ridiculous scene in which Harris saddles Wilde with his own dislike of women during pregnancy. Ah, yes, yes. Ah, to be sure. Yes, yes. No wonder, I thought, the Irish problem is insoluble. It is not a question of whitewashing Wilde, I persisted, or even of taking Sherard's view of him. It's simply a question of making it clear that no confidence at all is to be placed in Harris's Wilde, which, on the strength of your endorsement, is everywhere accepted as the true account of Wilde.
Oscar could be really charming at times.
At the end of an hour, I gave it up. Mr. Shaw escorted me out of his flat and along the passage to the lift. I entered the lift, which contained three women, and as it began to descend, I saw Mr. Shaw smiling benignly down on me. Bernard Shaw, the three women gasped. It was an impressive moment, but it would have been more impressive to me if Mr. Shaw had consented to repair the damage which he had done to the most brilliant wit and dramatist of his generation. Public men are naturally reluctant to impair their prestige by withdrawing their pronouncements, but in this instance Mr. Shaw had simply to remind the world that since giving his endorsement of Harris's Wilde, he had experienced in his own person what it felt like to be the subject of a biography by Frank Harris. An experience, the rigours of which, he has himself told us, he very wisely mitigated by revising Harris's Bernard Shaw before publication, and in many places entirely rewriting it. Hugh Kingsmill, London, November 1932. Note. Mr. Kingsmill's interview with Mr. Shaw was originally intended to be used as a preface to my as-yet-unpublished book, George, Frank and Oscar, described lower down in the interview. Enthusiastically recommended by his reader, it was accepted for publication by Mr. Werner Laurie, who 3 weeks later changed his mind and withdrew the inadequate offer he had made for it. It was then sent in turn to John Lane, Gerald Duckworth, and Jonathan Cape, of whom the latter two publishers at least never even opened Curtis Brown's parcel, for when this eventually homed to Corsica, it was found to contain a note from the agent's manager to some member of Gerald Duckworth's staff. In America, Horace Liverite and Brentano's admired it greatly, but the slump was then at its blackest, and Frank Harris being entirely discredited in the USA, where poor Oscar no longer cuts much ice, and George Bernard Shaw of the Apple Cart and other worse fiascos ranks as a has-been and a back number, a book about these three gentlemen was not considered to have great sales possibilities. The same reason for its rejection was given me only quite recently by A.A. Knopf, Inc., who, though they described it as absorbing reading, considered that, as both Wilde and Harris were dead, and Harris's Life of Shaw had aroused no interest in the States, a book mainly concerned with these three people was not likely to be very profitable. The painful fact seems to be, as was impressed upon me by a cynical London editor, who, however, utterly failed to convince me, that the public is interested only in Wilde as perverted, a criminal, and a monster, and not in the least in the Wilde Ada Rehan has pictured, and whom I have known, admired, and loved for over 50 years. On reading this interview, I couldn't help feeling that Shaw's contemptuous refusal even to glance at my proof of Harris's falsehoods may have been prompted by some rancour he harboured against my humble self, who 36 years ago, with my little book, The White Slaves of England, accomplished in 10 weeks what Shaw and his cunctating brother Fabians had failed to do in 10 years of soapbox orating, forced England to recognise the rights of her very poor. As usual, it is mainly the wrong people who have profited by the revolution I then brought about, but some lasting good was done. But enough. My task today is a more arduous one. Heavens! The task of shooing hyenas away from the graves of the illustrious dead. Robert Harborough Sherard, Calvi, Corsica, July 31st, 1933. Revised June 1934. End of section 4. Read by Rob Marland. End of Oscar Wilde Twice Defended by Robert Harborough Sherard. For more information or to volunteer, please visit legimus.eu.